After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the biggest ISIS stronghold in Iraq seems on the verge of falling to U.S.-backed forces. We go into the streets to see if a major victory over radical Islam is really at hand. And back in the United States, he tweets they overreact. Why the smartest minds in finance cannot predict the Trump effect on stock prices. It's Thursday, February 23rd. In the war against ISIS, its last great base in Iraq, its on-the-ground claim to a religious empire, lies in one half of one city. For those who want to see ISIS destroyed, its final chapter in Iraq is perhaps being written now, and it's being written in Mosul.
So Mosul right now is a divided city.
Rukmini Kalamaki, who has covered ISIS for years, has been in and out of Mosul for the past few months.
The eastern half was declared liberated at the end of January, and most of those neighborhoods, to be perfectly frank, look pretty normal to me. You drive around, you see vegetable sellers, open markets, customers.
I'm now trying on the burqa. What is this? Like this? Oh my God.
Restaurants are open. I was able to have lunch in a beautiful Mosul restaurant. But the liberated part of the city ends at the Tigris River, which essentially cuts the city in two. The western part of Mosul is still completely under ISIS occupation. And that's the part where Iraqi forces are now inching towards. And it's a no-go zone. We've been told to not move around there unless you're in an armored vehicle. And even from the armored vehicle, you can hear the volleys going overhead, the occasional mortar rounds, and, you know, the rat-a-tat of machine gun fire.
It's into this western half that Iraqi forces are now preparing to mount the second stage of their assault on the Islamic State. If they regain control, they'll reunite Mosul and liberate a city that has been under ISIS rule for nearly 3 years. Planes flew overhead this week, carpeting the ground with leaflets. "This is your last opportunity to quit your work with ISIS," they said. "Stay at home," raising the white flag as the forces approach. I talked to Rukmini last night from her hotel in Iraq about what she's seeing and what this fight means.
Mosul is the most important city for ISIS in Iraq. This is really where they planted their flag. In June of 2014, when Mosul fell, that was really the moment, I think, when the world woke up and went, oh my God, you know, what is this group? And it was in Mosul that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, declared the caliphate in June of 2014. So for that reason alone, it has enormous significance.
And when we say the caliphate, can you remind us of exactly what it is?
The caliphate, in the eyes of the Islamic State, is basically the territory where their version, their very narrow version of Islam is practiced. In their mind, this is what the entire world should be. I've seen Islamic State maps where they basically have the black flag planted in every country on the planet. But to them, this is the beachhead. From here, they're going to colonize the world.
And if it were to be lost, what would that say about ISIS and its future and the future of the caliphate?
Number one, it'll be a symbolic blow to the caliphate. Number two, there'll be, I think, a significant economic downturn for ISIS. ISIS makes most of its money from taxes. I know there's a perception out there that they make most of their money from oil.
There is.
That's not the case. Right. Right. Oil is a part of their income stream, but it's not the biggest slice of the pie. The biggest slice of the pie is taxes. And so taxes come from controlling people and land. Every single household in Mosul had to pay a monthly tax to ISIS. ISIS would go house to house to collect this, and you had to pay up, right? So as far as its economics, Mosul is also important in that way.
You have this really unusually up-close view of what life is like under ISIS, and very few people have it. What is day-to-day existence like in Mosul under ISIS control?
So first of all, that answer is different depending on your gender. If you're a woman, your life is mostly indoors. The Islamic State made it almost impossible for women to have any life outside of the home. They were hounded by the religious police for the most minor of infractions, including not covering their hands or showing their eyes. For men, on the other hand, if you're an adherent of the Islamic State and are not suspected of dissent of any kind, then you went about your daily life in a somewhat normal way. So doctors were able to practice medicine, merchants continued to sell their wares, bureaucrats, you know, went to the office. The difference was that there was a veneer of Sharia law that was placed over everything. So for example, smoking was forbidden, drinking, of course, was taboo. You had to wear your trousers at a particular length in keeping with their reading of how the Prophet Muhammad used to dress. You had to obey all of the five prayers. And if you didn't close your shop on Fridays during the major Friday prayer, you would be reprimanded or worse.
And what happened if you did oppose these strictures?
There's just no flexibility at all. I mean, people that raised their heads in any way were immediately imprisoned, and executions were public. They were happening in regular intervals. People talked about how they'd be going to the market just to buy a kilogram of meat, and they would come across a scene where they were stoning to death a couple for allegations of adultery, or they would walk past the place where they were about to behead somebody who was accused of sorcery or whatever crime they allocated to them.
You're describing the culture of life under ISIS, and I'm trying to understand if a sizable portion of the population there sided with ISIS over the Iraqi government, if they were finding themselves sympathetic to this in one way or another when it comes to kind of the hearts and minds factor at play with all of this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. I think the numbers speak volumes. I was told that before ISIS's invasion, the population of Mosul was around 2 million. After ISIS, and at the beginning of the intervention by the Iraqi army to try to take it back last fall, the city still had a population that was estimated at 1 million. So basically, half the population managed to flee, but half stayed. And of that half that stayed, there are certainly people that were, like my translator. My translator explained that the reason he didn't leave is that he and his father own a beautiful home. And had they left, the home would have been seized by ISIS and it would have been destroyed. And that's the family's main wealth. So they chose to stay and they managed to get to the end of this difficult nearly three-year stint. But beyond people like my translator, you have to imagine that there were quite a good number of people that did collaborate with them. You know, they were on the Islamic State's payroll, either as traffic cops or as members of the religious police or as petty bureaucrats. And at some level, they must have been okay with that.
Because they stayed.
Because they stayed. And that's the thing that we are all, you know, wrestling with. It's easy to see how there could have been a reaction to the perceived corruption, of the Iraqi state. So initially, I think ISIS brought this order and they brought a promise of ending corruption. You could see how in the beginning this would have been appealing. But as the brutality multiplied and as the extremeness of the group increased, it's surprising to me how many people did collaborate with them. And that's something that I'm trying very hard to understand, you know, on this trip.
I want to talk about when these Iraqi soldiers are going through the streets, how exactly do they fight ISIS? How do they even know that they're looking at ISIS?
It's urban warfare. I mean, what ISIS has been doing is aggressively using suicide bombers, car bombs, to create spectacular explosions and basically spook the advancing army. The other thing that they're doing is all over East and West Mosul. In East Mosul, in just one little district called Tilkif, on just one morning where I was there, mm-hmm. I was shown four or five enormous tunnels that had been built in people's living rooms. So you go into the house and there's basically a hole the size of the living room, dirt in every other room of the house. In some instances, the dirt was all the way up to the ceiling. And then you peer down into this black hole that we were told, you know, extends for hundreds of yards in certain instances. So they use them to hide, and they use them to be able to move from building to building without the coalition being able to see them from the air.
I mean, they're literally crawling underneath the forces trying to stamp them out.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the other technique that they're using to great effect in recent months is they've been using drones that, as far as we can tell, are just commercially available drones that you can buy in malls, you know, across the region. They've been able to engineer them to carry explosives.
Wow.
Usually it's quite small. It'll be like a grenade or two. But everywhere where I've been with the Iraqi army, they're constantly talking about this. So this is an army that was used to being able to move against the Islamic State and having the air advantage on their side. You know,
right, the drones.
That had the drones, right, literally the drones. And now suddenly they have suffered injuries and casualties from these drone attacks. And they're becoming more and more frequent, which to me suggests that ISIS is becoming better and better at using them.
So we're now about halfway through the effort to liberate Mosul by the coalition forces led by the Iraqi army.
Yes.
What at this point is the official public version of what's happened in that effort to end the Islamic State control of Mosul?
So the public version is that eastern Mosul is now fully liberated.
And is that accurate?
So it's partially accurate. I mean, in most of eastern Mosul, life has returned to some semblance of normalcy. But ISIS infiltration continues. I was invited by an Iraqi armed force to go on a night raid in the district of Tilkif. And funnily enough, I had been in Tilkif maybe 2 days earlier, and my impression was that Tilkif was liberated and free and safe. I was walking around, you know, without even a veil on my head, thinking that I was safe. And we then proceeded to go on a night raid where this Iraqi militia was going house to house looking for ISIS suspects. And in the course of that night, they pulled men from their homes. And in front of me, two of those men admitted right away to being ISIS.
Wow.
when they were questioned by the Iraqi army. So I kind of did a... It was a double take for me because I had been there, you know, just days earlier and had felt, you know, quite safe. And there was ISIS, you know, in our midst. This has been the story in pretty much every area that has been liberated, both by Iraqi forces and by Kurdish forces in further north in Iraq and by a combination of forces in Syria. You'll see an area declared liberated and then... Days, if not weeks later, suicide bombings will begin again, street fights will erupt, and for that reason, I think, I'm loath to declare victory over this group, because even once we clear the cities completely of their fighters, there is still the problem of the ideology. And I don't think that anybody has yet figured out how to kill an idea, because in the end, what they are preaching is an idea.
We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for the New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to the New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
Investors on Wall Street and in Silicon Valley have been analyzing Twitter as part of their trading strategies for years. But those strategies never anticipated the 140-character bursts of Donald Trump.
We just got in a tweet from the president-elect Donald Trump on Twitter.
President-elect Trump has no problem using social media to call out big business.
This morning, Donald Trump tweeted that the costs of Lockheed Martin's F-35 program were
out of control. More than $4 billion. Cancel order.
He says Toyota Motor said we'll build new plant in Baja, Mexico.
No way. Build a plant in U.S. or pay big border tax.
It was quickly retweeted. It was liked.
After the tweet, Lockheed shares tumbled almost 3%.
Minutes after, you saw Boeing stock slide 1%.
Mr. Trump's tweet caused Boeing stock to plunge before recovering throughout the day.
Well, I think we've seen some really interesting responses to these moments where the president calls out some specific company.
Nathaniel Popper writes about technology and finance.
Even before he took office, he called out Ford.
Here's the tweet that was sent out last night by the president-elect.
Sort of congratulated them for scrapping their plans to build a factory in Mexico.
He says, just got off the phone with my friend Bill Ford, chairman of Ford, who advised me that he will be keeping the Lincoln plant in Kentucky. No Mexico.
And, you know, initially, I think traders, investors thought this was going to be a good thing for Ford. And the stock shot up that day.
Why not? What could be better than to have the president endorse you?
You'd think that is a pretty good celebrity endorsement. And it was that day. But pretty quickly, people began sort of second guessing that. And the stock turned around and lost all of the gains it had made that day and is now down.
Because that one factory Trump liked and tweeted about didn't change Ford's business.
Yes. And that's just one of the instances in which these tweets and the way you'd expect them to play out just totally didn't work out the way people thought.
All right. So in the case of Ford, how exactly is that trading working? What's going on behind the scenes that we have to understand?
Well, really, before that tweet is on CNBC and newspapers are talking about it, before that even happens, there are computer systems at Wall Street firms, at trading firms, that are essentially taking every tweet that comes in from the president and crunching it, identifying the companies that are named, and in a sort of more complicated piece of the puzzle, they're actually identifying the sentiment of that tweet. These computer systems are able to figure all of that out and place a trade based on its conclusion before you or I could even read the whole tweet.
And it sounds like these computer systems are misjudging something, maybe sentiment.
Yes. I mean, these computer systems are built with the very rational, I think, expectation that if the president says something negative about a company, it is going to be bad for that company.
Right.
I mean, and, you know, we saw a great example of this with Nordstrom's when the president lashed out at Nordstrom's. Computer systems, you know, immediately sent the stock plunging. It fell, you know, 1% within a minute, which is a big move. But as soon as everybody out in the public started reading that tweet and hearing about it, they realized, you know what? This could be a good thing for Nordstrom's brand. Nordstrom isn't necessarily trying to sell its products to Trump's followers. They're trying to sell to this elite audience that might actually think it's a good thing if this particular president doesn't like Nordstrom's.
So what is it that these computers are getting wrong?
I think that what these trading firms and investors are struggling with is really the same thing that everyone in the world essentially is struggling with these days, which is that it's not clear the relation between what Donald Trump says and what he ends up doing. A lot of traders have come to the conclusion that his bark is worse than his bite.
So how can Wall Street, and how is Wall Street, trying to better judge exactly what Trump's words about a company will mean for that company's stock price?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of sophisticated investors who don't have to place a bet on a stock's day-to-day movement, you know, people who are holding investments for the longer term, are realizing that the better thing to do when it comes to Donald Trump is to do nothing. And so I think people are, if anything, backing away from the stocks that he talks about, just realizing that in the long run, you can't really game this. You just have to leave it alone.
Nathaniel, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here's what else you need to know today. A fight has erupted inside the Trump White House over transgender students, pitting Education Secretary Betsy DeVos against Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Until Wednesday night, schools across the country had to allow transgender students to use the bathroom of their choice, male or female. But under a Trump executive order, that decision will now be left to state governments.
I've made this clear, and the president's made it clear throughout the campaign, that he's a firm believer in states' rights and that certain issues like this are not best dealt with at the federal level.
DeVos opposes the change. Sessions supports it. That left the decision to President Trump, who sided with Sessions in signing the order. New emails reveal the degree to which the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, coordinated with oil and gas companies to roll back environmental regulations in his last job as Attorney General of Oklahoma. Those companies and their allies provided Pruitt with the precise language they wanted him to use to fight federal environmental rules, and they thanked Pruitt's office for, quote, all they are doing to push back against Obama's EPA. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.